So I just come back from teaching a retreat over in Thailand. And like many people throughout the world, one of the most difficult parts of meditation is getting started and getting into a peaceful state of mind. And once you're into a peaceful state of mind, it's pretty easy to stay there. But actually getting there is one of the hardest. And it was just like going to Bangkok. If you've ever been to Bangkok, there is these long tail boats which go up and down the river Chao Phraya. And I remember as a young monk going on, they're like taxi boats. So it's a great way of getting into the and up and down the city without getting caught in the traffic. So I remember going on one of those boats once with another monk, but when it sort of docks, you have to jump off pretty quickly and jump on pretty quickly, because if you hesitate and you jump, it's already moved off, you end up in the river. And I remember one monk, and I jumped off pretty quickly and smartly, as I was told you had to, but this other monk hesitated. And I saw him going down the river, we were separated, he didn't know where to go next, so I was looking for him the rest of the day. But he had to be very quick to jump on. And that's part of the simile this afternoon. If you're really going to get into some nice meditation, you've got to jump on quickly into sort of the boat which leads to peace and quiet. If you mess around too much at the beginning, sometimes you lose an opportunity to get peaceful and quiet. The boat has left the dock and you can't get back on it again. So it is important at the very beginning, preparation, reminding yourself, this is my meditation time. And it's not the time to think about your problems and work out all your plans. You have to sort of set the scene, first of all, before you meditate. Because, yes, we all have unfinished business to do. We all have many things which we have to do when we leave here. There's so many things we can think about, contemplate, plan and work out. You can even philosophize about the meaning of life, but this is not the time to do so. In meditation, it's a time we put aside for one thing and one thing only, and that's the stilling of the mind, making it nice and peaceful and calm. And if one remembers that that is the main purpose, one is setting the mind up in the right direction from the very, very beginning, so one doesn't really waste too much time. So that's actually helpful at the beginning of the meditation to almost make a resolution, a determination, to set the scene, to tell the mind, mind, this is my meditation time. Yes, I've got many things to think about, many things to do, but not now. This is that time I put aside for one thing and one thing only. And of course, to convince yourself you deserve to have a rest. Not only do you deserve to have a rest for the sake of your health, both physical and mental, but also to convince yourself it is actually worthwhile to be able to get some stillness, to get some peace, because once the mind has rested, once the mind is still, its ability to figure out problems, to work out what needs to be done, is actually enhanced. Time spent in meditation is not time lost from the time you have to work and to solve the problems of your life. Meditation instead should be looked upon as an investment in building up the mental energies, so when you come out of meditation, you can actually use your mental faculties with far greater efficiency. Some people keep saying, oh, they've got no time to meditate, they're so busy. I say, yes, if you're so busy, you have to meditate, because you've got no time to waste, you have to use your brain efficiently. And I think everybody knows that sometimes when we're very busy, our mind gets scattered. And because it gets scattered, it never really focuses on one thing long enough to actually to get things done. And so if we can just remember that instead of just running around backwards and forwards, doing things inefficiently, making mistakes, bumping into things metaphorically, instead we just stop for a while. Say, yes, this is important, to be peaceful, to be quiet, to be still. And once we are peaceful, kind and quiet and still, when we come out afterwards, whatever we need to do in life, we can do efficiently, focused, without being scattered. We get more done in less time. So it's an investment in the efficiency, in the efficient use of your brain. So these are just little marketing strategies, if you don't mind the expression, to convince yourself it's worthwhile to dedicate, the whole meditation time to silence, to peace, to stillness, and to push aside all this work of solving problems and doing things for a later time. And if you can do that at the very beginning, you soon sort of get into a state of peacefulness. And once you can feel that state of peacefulness, you know, you can get a feeling for it, connect to it, and then it is usually so delightful, it's very easy to maintain that peace and stillness, simply because it is just nice to stay with, and the mind very easily stays with that which it feels comfortable, beautiful, nice. So if you can get into there quickly, recognize it's peaceful and still, then it's easy to stay. But while I was in Phuket, people were saying again and again and again they had trouble calming their mind because this was a retreat for the first few days for new meditators. Some had never meditated before in their lives. And I had to try and take them into a place where they could be comfortable, peaceful and still. And one of the little techniques which I was trying to teach them, because their wandering mind, thinking, they could hardly stop thinking, was actually to use the mantra technique. A mantra technique in meditation is only something you use at the very beginning of the meditation. It's like a group of words which you say to yourself over and over again. And what it does, it substitutes, you know, a group of words for you thinking about all sorts of things in your life. So instead of thinking about past and future and business and relationships and all the jobs you need to do and working out the problems of your life, we put just a group of words which we link together as a mantra. We say that again and again and again. So it literally blocks out the ability to think about all sorts of things. And because the group I was teaching, they're not just Theravadan Buddhists, they're all Buddhists from all sorts of places, I decided just to introduce to them the very famous Buddhist mantra. It's a Tibetan mantra, but who cares what the mantra is, because it's the way you use it which was most important, the old Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. But what I was saying, that when you start meditating, if you can't stop thinking, what I wanted you to do, I said, is to chant that mantra to yourself, but most importantly, with spaces in between the syllables. And that was the most important part. For those of you who die hard Theravadas, you can do Namo Tassa Bhagavato if you like. But the important thing is to put spaces between each syllable, Namo Ta, sa. But with Om Mani Padme Hum, you chant to yourself the Om, leave a space, Mani Padme Hum. Because when you chant that to yourself, you know, silently inside your own head, you chant that to yourself, it means it blocks out all of the thoughts. You can't be thinking and keep reciting the mantra to yourself at the same time. And as the thoughts get less, you extend the spaces between the words. So you may start with Om Mani Padme Hum, and then you extend the spaces, Om Mani Padme Hum. Because the most important part of that mantra is the spaces. Because when you have those spaces, then you can notice the beauty of that silence, the joy of it, the delight in it. And once that perception of that silence is established, you can drop the mantra. It's as if the spaces between the words take up all of the mind's attention, and the words are not necessary anymore. It's as if those words, those little syllables, that they are just there as packaging for the silence. Like whenever you get any gift, it's always packaged in a box with paper on. That's what those words are there for, a package. And what they contain is the silence which comes afterwards and which is there before. And so one uses a mantra to get to that silence. But the most important thing is remembering the spaces in between. And I had great success in the retreat I was teaching over in Thailand by getting people to do that recitation at the beginning of the meditation. Again, first of all, this is my meditation time, to convince the mind, psyching the mind up that this is what the whole purpose of this 40, 45 minutes is for. And then sort of doing a little recitation to yourself and noticing, deliberately putting spaces between the syllables so that those spaces would increase, you get to have the perception of silence of peace, and that perception of silence will become so attractive that after a while the mind will turn to that and the whole mantra will drop away. You wouldn't need to keep saying it anymore. So that is a skillful means of stopping that thinking mind, especially at the very beginning of the meditation, to get on the boat of meditation as quickly as possible. And once you have that silence, you have that peace in the mind, then, of course, you can really take it much, much deeper. As I've taught here many times before, as you do get into a silence, it always will be in the present moment. Present moment usually comes first, but if you just jump to the silence of the mind, you do the two things at the same time. You're present and you are silent. And then once you are silent there, then usually the things like the experience of the breath come up quite naturally, simply because that when you are silent, when the body is still, there's nothing much happening. And the only thing which is really moving is the breath going in and out, in and out, in and out. And so, number one, it's the only thing left when everything settles down and disappears. And number two, it is naturally a very calming and reassuring rhythm, the rhythm of your breath. I worked out some years ago that one of the reasons why the rhythm of the breath is reassuring and comforting is probably because of some subconscious memory of the early months of our life, either in our mother's womb or on her tummy, maybe breastfeeding, and feeling the rhythm of her breathing up and down. And so that particular rhythm of the breath is not too fast, it's not too slow, it's comforting, reassuring, which means the mind has no trouble staying on that breath, keeping with it, because it's a delightful place to be. It's a reassuring rhythm. And so that usually that's what happens. As one goes into that silence, the next thing which happens is just the breath is there and you're aware of it. And then just the breath settles down. That's where you get into the deeper meditations. But most important thing is, no matter where you are in that meditation, it's a sense of peace, a sense of delight, the sense of contentment, which comes up at every stage of the meditation, which is really deepened as one meditates. So don't just say you're doing the breath meditation, don't just be aware of the breath. Be also aware of the sense of peace and comfort and contentment, which is there when you start watching the breath with a degree of mindfulness. It just is a beautiful place to stay. And so by developing from the very beginning, this is my meditation time, this is what I set aside for peace, for stillness, for contentment, then what you set out to do, you're achieving in greater and greater degrees as you meditate. You're feeling, yes, I'm getting somewhere. I'm being peaceful, I'm being still. I'm getting this beautiful sense of contentment in my meditation. And if you keep on the lookout for that sense of contentment, peace, throughout the meditation, you'll be able to find it. And once you start noticing that, that is really the boat which you jump on, which takes you into deeper meditation. It's a boat of peace, contentment, stillness. That is the most important thing. All of the other objects, you might actually say, and this is quite a profound, are secondary. Whether you're watching the breath, whether you're doing a mantra, no matter what you think your object is, the most important thing which you are developing is this feeling, this perception of peace, contentment, stillness. So keep that as the main object. And the other ones are secondary. The present moment awareness or the silence, the mantra, watching the feelings in the body, watching the breath, these are all secondary. The main object which one should start to perceive is this feeling of peace, this feeling of contentment, this feeling of stillness. And that will take you into a very, very deep meditation. Okay, so that's just a little introduction, just to get people settled in and to give a little bit of direction. And of course, every time I'm here, I try to give a slightly different angle on the meditation. So by coming here regularly, you get more and more angles on the same thing. So your repertoire of skillful means increases as you develop your meditation practice. So there we go. And before we actually begin our meditation now, once again, anyone here who is coming for the introductory meditation class, that is in the room to my right. This is the ongoing class, because we're now going to be meditating for 45 minutes. Haven't done that before, sometimes it's a bit tough. So off we go. So if you'd like to get yourselves ready, and we can start our meditation in a few moments. So here we go. So get yourselves comfortable in your own meditation posture. Okay, it doesn't need to be on the floor, chairs are fine. Because if you haven't got a degree of comfort in your body is going to disturb you, take away all of your attention, and stop any peace, stillness, and contentment from arising. So it's great to be able to sit on the floor, but if it's painful, sit on a chair. So once the body is reasonably settled, you can tell your body and mind that this is my meditation time. It's a period I set aside in my life for one thing and one thing only: the development of peace, stillness, contentment. I'm not going to use this period for working out the problems of my past and figuring it all out. Nor am I going to use this time for planning what I'm going to do when I leave here or later on. Nor am I going to use this time for dreaming and fantasizing or philosophizing. Nor for working out the meaning of life. It's just for stillness, for peace, for contentment. That is the purpose of this 45 minutes. It's not work time. It's rest, freedom, peace time. And when you tell yourself that, pay full attention. Because when you instruct the mind with full attention, you'll find the mind will comply. A lot of the time, my mind just needs to be told what I want it to do. And it will act accordingly. A lot of time it's confused, it doesn't know what I want it to do. That's why it will get restless. So give it clear instructions. Mind, for the next 45 minutes, our main task is just to be peaceful, to be content, to experience stillness. And that will linger in the mind through the period of the meditation. And then look again at your body to make sure the body is content, is peaceful, and can be maintained in stillness. Just by observing the body, adjusting it where necessary, being kind to it. So you learn from experience that to keep the body comfortable for long periods of time, it has to start off being comfortable. A little ache or an irritation at the beginning could very easily grow into a huge pain, which is unendurable during the middle of the meditation, forcing you to move. Get it right at the beginning, and it's right throughout the period of meditation. So I always like to spend a little bit of time with my body at the beginning. It also helps me establish my mindfulness in this present moment. It also helps me start generating this feeling of care, compassion, kindness, focus within to my own body and mind rather than to other people. This is the time for metta, for love towards one's own body and mind. Relaxing to the max. till everything settles down. Then if you like to try the mantra method, you can just recite to yourself your favorite mantra, this group of words, not too long, whether it's Om Mani Padme Hum or Buddhang Saranangacharami or Namo Tassa, whatever. But as you recite these words to yourself, this phrase to yourself, over and over and over, please put the spaces between the syllables. Om Mani Padme Hum or Bhutan Samanang Gacchami. In the spaces, that's where the meditation grows. And when silence, present moment awareness, when that degree of mindfulness is established, then the mantra has done its job. And you can go towards your breath, if the breath doesn't happen naturally, and continue the meditation as usual from there. It's getting very close to the end of the meditation now. It's a time to review how you feel. There's how much peace, how much contentment, how much stillness exists in your mind right now. And what it feels like, what it actually is as an experience. And also to contemplate the causes of such peace, contentment and stillness. Why do you feel this way? How have you arrived here? This is where we get to learn how we gain insight into the way of meditation and what it means. I'm now going to ring the gong 3 times. The end of the third ringing from the gong, come out from your meditation. Sometimes I get asked the question, what has this got to do with that part of meditation called insight? As if insight meditation was somehow separate. But the last few minutes of the meditation where I generally ask people to know the state of their mind and also know where it came from. This is where we get insight into 2 things. Insight, what it's like to be peaceful, what peace really is. And also, why, what's its cause. This is a basic insight in Buddhism called the 4 Noble Truths. What is suffering, what's its cause? What's the absence of suffering, what's its cause? So you're experiencing this for yourself, this great sense of peace and freedom, being at ease with oneself and the world. At the end of the meditation, being content, not wanting anything else in the world. It's a great sense of happiness, coming home, fulfillment. It is felt to be like a spiritual goal achieved when one has this beautiful peace and contentment at the end of the meditation. So you're discovering from your own experience what that really means. Of course, you can't know peace, contentment, just as a theory. You've got to experience it first. So once you've experienced it, then you can get insight into its nature. Because it's right in front of you. You're there, you are peaceful. You are still. You are content. That's the only time you can really know it. So to gain the insight, first we have to generate that quality. And once it's generated, then we get to know it. That's where we get insight into its meaning. And it's quite frightening sometimes to think or to consider how few people know the meaning of peace. A simple word like that, they don't know the meaning because they've never experienced it. So first we have to have the experience. Then we can do the investigation. An investigation is not moving the mind backwards and forwards, just letting the mind linger on these qualities of mind, to linger long enough to get to know them. In the same way you get to know a person by hanging out with them. You don't go around investigating them and asking them tough questions. Just by being with them for a length of time, you get to know who they are. In the same way, by hanging out with peace, with things like contentment, with things like freedom, long enough, you can get to know who they are. You get great insights into these amazing qualities, you know, which, again, people, because they don't know what they're talking about when they talk of freedom, they haven't got no experience of stillness, of peace, contentment. Of course, there's no way they can really help others develop those qualities. Once we know it for ourselves, that's the first insight, know what these things are. And the second thing, we get the insight into how they're generated. I'm peaceful, I'm very peaceful, I'm not so peaceful. And you understand why. What you need to do to make the mind still and peaceful. In all those years I've been meditating, that you know, you sort of look and see that every time I put forth too much effort, I just agitate the mind. And I made those connections a long time ago. If you want the mind to be still, you're going to leave it alone. Because every time you get involved, you agitate the mind. And the same if you have a glass of water, or even better, a bowl of water. Every time you touch that bowl of water, every time you pick it up, every time you do something with it, you agitate the water. And you can see that because there's ripples on the surface. If you just leave that bowl of water alone, yeah, it starts off with being agitated, but then it gets less and less and less agitation. The ripples get less until it's perfectly still. And you know a bowl of water when it's still because it perfectly reflects sort of the scenery around it. It's like a mirror. And that's just a beautiful simile for the nature of the mind. Once it's still and peaceful, it gives a perfect reflection of the things around it. It's insight. So we get insight into what it feels like to be peaceful. But the most important insight is how peace comes about. Not by fighting. Not by trying to control things, by this beautiful act of letting go. And of course one gets insight into what this letting go really means. It's another question which so many people on retreats keep asking, yeah, I know I should let go, but how do I let go? What does letting go mean? Please help me. Because it's something we've never been trained at. In our lives, in our modern world, we're always taught how to do things. Always how to get involved and be responsible. And we're very good at that. In fact, we're too responsible, we're too involved. We carry too many burdens, we even carry the burdens of other people, which is really none of our business. But to be able to sit down and do nothing is a skill which is not taught in our schools and universities or in life, which is why one of the reasons why people get so stressed out, and of course depressed as well. Stress and depression, they go together as a pair. And there is a way through that. In this meditation, you learn just what peace is and how it comes about. Yeah, sometimes you experiment, you mess around, and sometimes you're agitated, sometimes it doesn't work. But there are times when it does work. There are times when you're sitting here and you get so still and so peaceful. There was, during the retreat which I gave in Phuket, there was this Thai girl, and just after the evening talk, sort of, you know, she went back to her room and just lay down to go to bed, but she wasn't tired. So, you know, laying down in bed, you know, what should I do? I'm not tired, I don't want to go to sleep, but, you know, there's nothing to do. So she started meditating, and she got a very, very peaceful meditation, one of the best of her life. And she came along, wow, I've been trying all day and I'm not getting anywhere. Now I go to bed, lay down, and it's suddenly very peaceful. Okay, now what I've been saying to you all those years I've known you, oh yeah, letting go. I suppose that was letting go. Of course it was letting go. She wasn't trying to meditate. She was just lying down. Number one, comfortable body. Number two, basically killing time. Nothing to do, so I might as well watch my breath. And that sort of lack of wanting a goal, that lack of trying, that lack of you know, doing something to get somewhere. She got a deep meditation. I said, now that's where you can mine that experience for insight. Learn. That's the way to meditate. So you get these experiences from time to time in your life. Almost the more you meditate, sooner or later, just by probability, you're going to sort of do something which makes you peaceful. And the insight is, ah, yes, now that must be the letting go. That's how it's done. And that's where you get the great insights from. And there's no greater insight into peace than the way to peace. You get that sort of clear in your head, and then you're a happy person, and also a very beautiful meditator. So that's where the insight comes in this very end of the meditation. Okay, any questions about what I've just been saying? About things which I should have said but didn't say. Better ask, because we're getting very close to the monastic retreat season. Because during the winter time, for 3 months, the monks and the nuns, we go and hide in our monasteries. We still sort of receive guests and teach in the monastery, but we don't come to Nolamara. So we've got one more Saturday afternoon, and that's the last time the monks or the nuns will be here. And then for 3 months until October, then we come back again. So if you've got any questions, it's either this week or next week, and then that's it. Of course, there'll still be the meditations going on, but they'll be conducted, I think, by some senior lay meditation teachers. But they'll be doing the meditation, but sometimes playing a little bit of a talk, sometimes answering questions. I'm not sure how it's going to be run, but every year it's run that way. But, yes? Yes, yeah. Yes, okay. There's some of the personal views which we have and being able to detach from those. A good example is, again, just from my training under a very wise monk, sometimes that monks would have arguments. And you go and see the teacher and try and get it settled. And you look at one of the monks and says, yes, you're correct, but you're not right. And you look at the other monk, you're right, but not correct. And that's a very beautiful way of seeing it, because, yeah, personal view, whatever personal view you have, yeah, you're right, but you're not correct. So what it's actually saying, it's not demeaning your view, it's having no value, but, you know, it's not correct enough. It's always like half-truth, because how can we know everything and, you know, have a view which is perfect and solid and fixed and true forever and ever? We don't have the ability. No one has the wisdom and the breadth of knowledge and wisdom to be true. So it's always an approximation. So that means we don't have to battle. And of course, the classic story, if you haven't seen this before, it's a classic Buddhist story which many people know. It's got out there wide and to many different religions. And I remember reading this in a book on Sufis, but it comes directly from the Buddha. It was a story, you know, the elephant and the seven blind men. In brief, seven blind men feeling a different part of the elephant, and the guy who felt the trunk said it's a snake, the guy who felt the leg said it's a tree trunk, and so on. And they all argued who was right, who was wrong. They all had their personal view, because they were blind, but they could actually feel it. But everybody's experience is limited. So they argued on what an elephant was. And instead of arguing my personal view against your view against someone else's view, the Buddhist way is, instead of contrasting our views, is combining them. And then these seven blind men, they They added their experience instead of arguing who's right and who's wrong. And they came up with this concept that an elephant is like a big rock on four tree trunks with a fly whisk on the back side. There's a big pot, you know, on the front, up a bit. And on either side of the pot, there's two fans, you know, the ears. Just under the fans is two ploughs and a big snake in the middle. Okay, now to a blind man, that's, you know, a pretty okay, workable description of what an elephant is if you never see it. And you can see that's much better. You take truth much further when we combine our personal views rather than we attach to them and say, mine is right, yours is wrong. Instead, we say, mine is correct, but it's not right. Yours is right, but not correct. So let's sit down, add everything together. We get a much better view. That means, number one, we don't have controversy and argument. And number two, we actually take our wisdom deeper. And I think it's a very positive way of looking at differences of views. But you'd always have your personal views. I'd have my personal views. And if I said I have no view, I mean, that's another view I have, the view that I have no view. You can't get out of it. We all have our views in life. The nice thing is that they grow rather than they become fixed. And that we sort of don't think that our view is perfectly, 100% absolutely truth. So we can always grow. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah. Okay, you've got an energetic mind, and how to actually employ that in a sort of a decent way. And it takes a lot of skill to deal with high energy in the same way that anybody can, you know, drive an old Toyota, but if it gave you a Lamborghini, which can go up to 200 kilometers an hour, 300 kilometers an hour, you need a lot of skill to drive a really powerful car. But, you know, those skills can be easily learned if you've got lots of energy. The main thing is just to settle it. So not so much direct it, but settle it down. So a lot of times we've got energy, it's always doing things and running around. If it's settled down, then it gets focused and concentrated and empowered. So, you know, sometimes that happens. I have drink too much tea or have a strong cup of coffee, because, you know, people give me a cup of coffee. Sometimes they put two tea bags in the tea or too much coffee, and so bang. So in order to do that, you just really let go. Settle down. And you get this energy, but it's directed energy rather than energy going all over the place. And that's the best way to focus it. And then it drives, it's beautiful. Very good. I don't know if that's a Lamborghini going out there, but I'm sure that, just wonder, we're just joking about that, just if you can have a souped up, what do they call the disabled vehicles? Don't know how fast they can go, but I'm sure that someone has got sort of the different grades, and rich people can get fast. Lamborghini style cars. I was meeting this guy, he's a designer, he's a very well-known designer in Singapore, and he designed a few dresses for Princess Diana. He came to stay in our monastery last year, but he was saying that he was starting a company for designer Zimmer frames. And it's a really good idea because, you know, Zimmer frames, you know, the walkers people use. And there's people with too much money, and all the Zimmer frames are the same. So, you know, like designer ones, you know, for, you know, elderly rich people, you know, with just, I don't know, jewels in it. I don't know what they can do in it, but sort of, you know, with funny colours. Because, you know, people like designer stuff, and, you know, if it's just restricted for a few elite customers, you can make a lot of money out of that. It's actually amazing, just when you really get into meditation, you actually can think outside the box, and you have all these amazing ideas. And if I was into business, I'd make a fortune by now, all the ideas which I've come up with, which some people would actually put into practice. So remember, it gives you an innovation. Oh, but I better sort of get the right idea because everyone else is coming out and it's 4:18, so it's 3 minutes past the time, so it's enough for this afternoon. And so if you want to come back, the next time I'll be here next week, Saturday afternoon, but that'll be the last one for 3 months. So happy meditating, and we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, just the three bows, and then we can go and do whatever we need to do.